Good morning. I will call to order this remote meeting of the House Commerce Committee and ask Mr. Brown to take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Present.
Vice Chair Cortese-Watoon.
Present.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Present.
Representative Barr.
Here.
Representative Carlson.
Carlson present.
Representative Daphne.
Present.
Representative Elkins.
Present.
Representative Haley. Representative Cagle.
Present.
Representative Lee.
Lee present.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly present.
Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard present.
Representative Lucero.
Happy morning.
Representative Olson.
Present.
Representative Farr.
Present.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen present.
Representative Richardson.
Present.
Representative Tice.
Present.
And Representative Haley. I believe she just joined us.
Present. Haley is present.
Thank you.
A quorum is present. Our first item of business is approval of our minutes from our last meeting. Representative Cortese-Watoon, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
I have, Mr. Chair. I would move the minutes from March 17th, 2021.
Any discussion to the Cortese-Watoon motion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails in the minutes from March 17th, 2021 are approved. The first item on our agenda is House File 832 by Vice Chair Cortese-Watoon. This is a bill that we heard earlier in the week and laid over just to make sure that members had a chance to review the amendment that was posted a little close to the hearing. Vice Chair Cortese-Watoon, would you like to move your bill?
Mr. Chair, yes, I would move House File 832 as amended be recommended to be placed on the general register.
Okay, Vice Chair Cortese-Watoon moves House File 832 as amended be recommended to register. Is there any discussion to the amendment that was late, that came late? I know we had a good discussion about the bill as a whole, but if there's discussion to the amendment, I don't hear any. Vice Chair Cortese-Watoon, do you have any closing comments? And could you renew your motion?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I did just want to give the committee a brief update. Senator Kiffmeyer and I continue to work with the lottery on language, and so they're, you know, we're all on board with the amended language that we passed earlier this week. I appreciate member support, and so it's a good bill. It's going to hopefully keep people safer as they bring in the big bucks.
Thank you very much, Vice Chair Cortese-Watoon.
So I would renew my motion.
Vice Chair Cortese-Watoon renews her motion that House File 832 as amended be recommended to be placed on the general register. Mr. Brown will take the roll. The chair votes aye.
Vice Chair Cortese-Watoon.
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Aye.
Representative Barr.
Aye.
Representative Carlson.
Carlson, aye.
Representative Daphne.
Aye.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Haley. Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard, aye.
Representative Lucero.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, aye.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Representative Tice.
Aye.
And Representative Haley.
With 17 ayes and zero nays, the motion prevails, and House File 832, as amended, is recommended to be placed on the general register. Next item on our agenda is House File 2044. We are lucky enough to be joined by Representative Lippert for the second time in 1 week. Representative Lippert, I will move that House File 2044 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Climate and Energy, Finance, and Policy. Representative Lippert, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 2044 creates a task force to establish the Innovative Finance Authority as an independent nonprofit organization in Minnesota. This will be a clean energy project and energy efficiency accelerator. The bill emerged because there are gaps in financing options that keep clean energy projects from moving forward. There's a massive need for energy efficiency in homes and apartments across the state, especially for families with low incomes. We need more financing options for these projects. And there are other projects, too, that would provide economic and environmental benefits that can use financing solutions, like helping farmers restructure their debt so they can put soil health building practices on their land that will improve water quality and benefit their bottom line over time, too. Financing authorities like these have proven very helpful in leveraging funds and accelerating the adoption of clean energy, energy efficiency projects, and more. There are 20 institutions like this in 12 different states. They typically leverage $3 to $8 for every dollar they invest. The McKnight Foundation recently completed a feasibility study for a financing authority like this in Minnesota and found that it would be very helpful in filling existing gaps in available financing and strengthening existing programs. The purpose of the authority is outlined in lines 4.1 to 4.5. When incorporated, it says this authority's purpose is to accelerate the deployment of clean energy and other qualified projects by reducing the upfront and total cost of their adoption, which it achieves by leveraging existing public sources and additional private sources of capital through the strategic deployment of its public funds in the form of loans, credit enhancement, and other financing mechanisms. We followed the advice of the study and created an independent nonprofit rather than a public or quasi-public institution. And we've also worked very closely with the St. Paul Port Authority and the Center for Energy and the Environment, current leaders in this clean energy lending space, to make sure this institution adds value. There will be no general fund money used to fund the Innovative Finance Authority. Our ask is for $10 million from the Renewable Development Account to capitalize the IFA. And the bill also outlines a task force membership, which includes the deed and commerce commissioners or a designee. With me to testify is Mr. Jeremy Kalin.
All right, so we will turn to the former state representative, Jeremy Kalin. Welcome, I'm assuming, back to the Commerce Committee. I'm sure you've presented bills here before, former Representative Kalin.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Good morning. It's my first time before your committee and members, first time before this committee in quite a while, at least. I am Jeremy Kalin. I'm an attorney at Avizon Legal in Minneapolis, and I co-lead our Impact Council practice. We're a boutique business law firm with 11 attorneys that work all over the country, and our Impact Council practice specifically is focused on deep sustainability, where I do most of my work, and on social venture and entrepreneurship. And as Representative Lippert described, this project really is at the intersection of doing good and supporting deep sustainability. The Innovation Finance Authority is really focused on those markets that are not able to access capital at scale right now in order to be able to make cost-effective and common sense improvements, from low-income rooftop solar and energy savings projects to affordable housing projects to the water quality improvements that Representative Lippert was describing, where we can do shoreline protection and avoid nutrients going into streams, and just the access to properly structured capital and to the kind of technical assistance in walking through the project as an owner rep that can really shake loose these projects. I'll just say that I've personally been involved in $293 million of small projects that the Innovation Finance Authority is really focused on, and I have seen exactly this need for private capital to be well structured, sometimes for public funds to de-risk to some small extent through loan loss reserves or credit enhancements. And often it's that technical assistance of kind of taking a pre-qualified project that makes sense and capital partners that are interested and committed, but doing that marriage of the two and then being able to achieve scale. As a former legislator from rural and ex-urban Chisago County and vice chair of the Five County East Central Regional Development Commission, it is near and dear to my heart that Representative Lippert's bill is truly statewide and can have that statewide benefit and make these resources available across the board. And as, of course, somebody who's been a champion of progress on the energy efficiency and renewable energy front broadly and making sure it's equitable across the board, the fact that Center for Energy and Environment, the St. Paul Port Authority, our credit unions in the state, and community banks like Sunrise and Bremer Bank are already engaged in this work, but recognize the need and opportunity of the finance authority to help shake them loose. So I think the last thing in terms of jurisdiction, Mr. Chair and members, is I believe that flow of funds will come as one-time funding from the renewable development account to the Department of Commerce. And then some funds will be available, a limited amount, to that task force while they go through the process of incorporating the nonprofit. And then the funds will be set aside almost entirely for that credit enhancement and loan loss reserve function, et cetera, not primary focus as direct loans, or direct grants, and become a self-supporting nonprofit under Chapter 317A of our laws. So with that, Mr. Chair, I think it's a really well-structured bill. Representative Lippert's put a ton of work into the bill and working with stakeholders, and I urge folks to support the bill and move it along, and I'm happy to answer any questions people might have.
Thank you, Mr. Kalin. That is the end of the author's testimony. No public members of the public signed up to testify, so now we will move to member questions and discussion. Any discussion to the bill? Representative Lucero.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The first question I would have is, I'm not immediately familiar, so could we just get an explanation as to who is the controlling authority, or how does a controlling authority or board work for a 501c3?
Representative Lippert, if you have an answer to that question, we also, I see Mr. Kalin has unmuted himself, so he might also know the answer. So feel free to defer to.
Sure. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Lucero. So that essentially there'll be a task force setting up the nonprofit to send it off as an independent entity, but it will stay connected to Commerce and Deed through the board. But I'll let Jeremy Kalin say more about it too.
Mr. Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lucero, great question. So as an independent nonprofit organization under Chapter 317A, is all Minnesota, the bulk of Minnesota nonprofit organizations are formed, a board of trustees, the board of directors will be appointed on formation and then have to, of course, go through, abide by the bylaws and by state law. What's unique is, rather than just spinning out a nonprofit organization, things like the Minnesota Historical Society is a great example, or the State Fair Foundation Board is another example where a nonprofit that has some responsibility or some connection to the state, we've stepped up even more that reporting, as you see at the end of the bill, in terms of the fiduciary responsibility with that $10 million. And I think lastly, I'll just say, Representative Lucero, having worked all over the country for the, including for the Secretary of Energy on clean energy financing structures for both the Obama administration and the start of the Trump administration, we deliberately discussed over the last few years setting up a new agency or a quasi-public agency, as Representative Lippert alluded to, and felt like in Minnesota, growing more government and appointing a new authority and all the responsibilities and challenges that come with that were probably not right. And so trying to be really responsible about being efficient and effective here.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the next question I would have, thank you for that, for the bill author or anybody who could answer, would be, the task force has not yet been, so there'd be a task force that would have to be created to set up a board that would run the nonprofit. So could we get some detail on how the task force, who's going to be appointed, who appoints to the task force, how many are going to be on the task force, how much time do they have to appoint or create the board, that aspect. Thank you.
Representative Kalin. Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lucero. So we're still sorting out the details of exactly what the task force need to look like in the timeline. Mr. Kalin may have more thoughts on what that could look like.
Representative Lucero, I think that's a, that. Sorry, Mr. Chair, please forgive me for jumping in. Yeah, the sole purpose of the task force is to incorporate the nonprofit and to set up that structure for the first, in terms of the new board, et cetera. So that, as Representative Lippert said, the membership, I think, is still a little bit open, wanting to make sure that folks do have the expertise in the in economic development and the related market segments and, of course, finance. But the timeline, I think the Mr. Elif, I believe, put in a timeline for August 15th or somewhere in that neighborhood for the task force members to be appointed. And then 2.5 or 3 months, I believe it's an October 1 or so deadline. Forgive me, I don't want to spend my time looking at the exact language in the bill to hunt for it, but it's somewhere in that neighborhood of early fall for the task force requiring to incorporate that nonprofit. And then at that point, the task force work is complete and the nonprofit is stood up and is governed by the laws and the oversight of the Attorney General's office, et cetera.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just doing a quick search, a keyword search here for task force to maybe get the answer. So how many members of the task force, did I hear correctly from Representative Lippert that this is still a work in progress? Is the details on who would qualify to be on the task force, the number of members on the task force, and who and how they would be appointed, is that still a work in progress, or is that detailed in the bill already? And if it is, could you point me to where what lines that is so I could just look at that?
Representative Lippert.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Lucero, I'm pulling up the language right now. So subdivision 4, line 6.9 to 6.23 talks, there's quite a bit of detail about the task force in there. There's still a few dots for the numbers of members appointed by the governor, Speaker of the House, President of the Senate, and then there's information about the expertise that's needed.
Lucero, any final questions?
No more questions, just a last comment. So I appreciate the indulgence. And I appreciate that. So I do see here on line 6.10, 6.11, the number of members is still to be determined. So here's where I have concern, is that we have a nonprofit that doesn't exist, that is yet to be created. We have a task force that the details of that task force are still a work in progress. And the discussion is to give $10 million to a nonprofit that doesn't exist, a task force that isn't finalized yet. I'm very concerned about giving this amount of money to something that appears to be.
Representative Lucero, if I could just, I'm sorry, I just want to say that the finance aspect of this is in the Energy Committee, which is where the bill is going to next, because it's RDA funding. It's not coming out of the Commerce budget. I think, you know, the proper focus of this committee is on the connection to the Commerce Department and how they would be involved in the setup, and then just on the idea of having a lending institution like this. So, you know, whether or not it's a good use of funds of the RDA is probably a question for the Energy Committee, where the bill will go to next. And I'm sure that some of these details will probably be developed in the Energy Committee, which has jurisdiction, is primary jurisdiction over the bill. We just, you know, frankly, this is a bill that I elected to hear in this committee to give the members a chance to review it, sort of out of abundance of caution, because it does touch on issues that we talk about a lot. And I think you flagged some important issues, but I just want to, so I'm not trying to steer you away from flagging issues. I just want to say that the finance piece is more of a question for the Energy Committee. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't really, because I referenced the word 10 million, it doesn't mean that the focus of what my concern was the 10 million. I just, what I was saying was, I think what I was leading to, if I'd start over now, is we have a nonprofit that doesn't exist yet. We have a task force that is still a work in progress in developing what it would even look like. My concern is that this appears to be a premature bill, not finalized. That's where I was leading at. And I think it doesn't need work. I don't think that it is ready for prime time, and I would have concern moving the bill forward in its present shape. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just two quick questions to the bill author, and thank you for being with us today, Representative Lippert, and having this conversation. First question I have is, did I understand correctly when you were talking about who's the appointing authority? It was the governor. And could you kind of run down who those individuals are that were going to be doing the appointing to your committee here or your commission?
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. So the language is in subdivision 4, line 6.9 to 6.25 or 24. So it says the advisory task force is established and consists of the following members: Commissioner of Commerce or the Commissioner's designee, Commissioner of Employment, Economic Development, or the Commissioner's designee, members appointed by the governor, members appointed by the Speaker of the House, members appointed by the President of the Senate.
Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Why the President of the Senate, not the Senate Majority Leader?
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll. I think it's, I'm not exactly sure why that's in there. Maybe Mr. Kalin knows. I think it's the leader of the Senate.
Representative O'Driscoll, what do you got against the President of the Senate?
Nothing. I'm just wanting to know why the President of the Senate, who is a presiding officer and not the caucus leader, but other caucus leaders are the ones who are going to end up making the appointment. So the bill may need some work there in that perspective, and I'll just leave it at that. But my second question is, speaking of the Senate, is the companion moving in the to this bill moving in the Senate today? Not specifically today, but is it on track to be moving, and what was the status?
We won't tell Senator Miller about your concerns. Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll. Yes, Senator Sinjum is carrying the bill in the Senate and had a hearing this week.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Representative Lippert.
Okay, Representative Farr.
Yeah, Representative Lippert, thanks for the bill. Just a quick question. Why not use our traditional finance institutions, and won't this compete with them?
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Farr, that's a very good question. It's a conversation we've been having with lending institutions very carefully because the reason that this bill is coming forward is because there are gaps in the marketplace. There are projects that need to be funded that haven't been funded. A study was done to assess whether, you know, these experiences that we're hearing are indeed the case, and the study confirmed that. Then we had been having conversations with current lenders in this space to make sure that this isn't duplicative, that it is indeed allowing for gaps to be filled, and that it's making existing programs stronger. Mr. Kalin may have more to say here too.
Mr. Kalin, if you have a brief response, I'll allow it.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Farr, great question. Page 4 of the bill, I think my line number's a little bit off from the version that I have, but starting with paragraph C, just speaks a little bit to the responsibilities, and including working with those existing finance authorities and utility programs, et cetera. So truly to be additive, as Representative Lippert stated, and just one example of where the finance authority could have accelerated a lot of progress that would have been helpful is the St. Paul Port Authority runs a financing program called Commercial PACE. That's used a lot as a clean energy financing mechanism, and extending it to nursing homes for air quality improvement and energy savings has been a challenge because of the requirements of running nursing homes and long-term care facilities. And so it took 2 years to even get a very small pilot up and running there, where the finance authority could have worked with the Port Authority and the Department of Human Services and even the Department of Health to improve indoor air quality, et cetera. Which of course would have could have really helped us a great deal with managing the pandemic and saving money and of course doing good for the environment. So just one example where the finance authority would be additive rather than displacing in any way, and where private capital can get the job done, Representative Farr, no need to spend the public resources to make it happen.
Representative Farr.
That's it. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Representative Haley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Lippert. Just a comment, Representative Lippert, as this moves on to energy, I believe. I would encourage you to speak with the Prairie Island Tribe and other tribes that live by dry cast storage facilities and are the reason that there is money going into an RDA account. And I would be interested in their feedback on this proposal, and also if they have interest, excuse me, losing my voice after a long week, if they have interest in serving on the board or serving on the task force. So just wanted to offer that suggestion. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's a good idea. Representative Lippert, I see no further members seeking recognition. Do you have any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the discussion. I would just say clearly that I think the need is clear, and this would step into some existing gaps. Task force is the way we set this up, and I think this institution will meet some significant needs in the state. So I appreciate your hearing, and I hope to have your support.
Thank you, Representative Lippert. I will renew my motion that House File 2044 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Climate and Energy Finance and Policy. Mr. Brown will take the roll. The chair votes aye.
Vice Chair Katizowatune.
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll.
No.
Representative Barr.
Nope.
Representative Carlson.
Carlson, aye.
Representative Daphne. Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Haley.
No.
Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard, aye.
Representative Lucero.
No.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
No.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, no.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Representative Tice.
No.
One second.
With 10 ayes and 7 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 2044 is recommended to be referred to the Committee on Climate, Energy, Finance, and Policy. Thank you, Representative Lippert. Next, we will welcome to the committee Representative Cleburne and House File 1768. I will move House File 1768 be recommended to be placed on the general register. Representative Cleburne, we have an author's amendment labeled DE1. I'll move the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that you'd like the committee to consider it. I might sneeze. Would you please describe the amendment while I see if I sneeze?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members. I thank you for this opportunity to be with you this morning to bring forward House File 1768 and the DE1. I'll just speak to very briefly. The DE1 is a compromise between interested stakeholders and the Department of Commerce. Last fall, during conversations with interested stakeholders in the Department of Commerce about how to move continuing education courses online, the Commerce Department issued a bulletin that provided an interpretation of current law that related to prohibited practices. And in this bulletin, it created some confusion among the continuing education providers. And this DE is really important because what it does is it outlines exceptions to prohibitive activities, so it clarifies confusion. Do you want me to go on, Mr. Chair, about what the DE does in specific terms, or is that enough for this moment?
I think that's enough for this moment. If you're comfortable with it, we'll maybe adopt it, and then we'll let you continue. Any discussion to the DE1, an author's amendment, which gets the bill in the shape that the author would like the committee to consider it? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the DE1 is adopted. Representative Cleburne, to your bill.
Thank you very much. Members, as you well know, many professional license holders have to take continuing education. And this bill specifically addresses the continuing education for realtors, commercial real estate agents, and insurance agents. And it clarifies what is not a prohibited practice in presenting those continuing education courses. Specifically, it allows the continuing education providers to do the following things. And please note that these are abbreviated descriptions. There's a more full description in the DE itself. But it allows them to, one, display a logo of a company and company branding. It allows the providers to put a trade show booth outside of the classroom and separate from the registration table. It allows the display of a logo to thank sponsors or underwriters during a break. And then lastly, it allows the third-party logo to be displayed on the course program. And the course program is very specifically described as the literature detailing the schedule of events, the presenters, the course detail, and background information. This is a compromise bill. The language has been negotiated between the stakeholders and the Department of Commerce. You will see in your packets today a letter of support. I believe there are 7 or 8 entities on that letter of support that support this. And Mr. Chair, with me today are professionals from the industry and the Department of Commerce who would like to testify to the bill. And so at this time, I would just ask you to acknowledge Mr. Reich.
Yes, I will ask Mr. Reich to the committee. John Reich. Oh,
thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is John Reich with Winthrop & Weinstein Law Firm, and I'm representing the Minnesota Real Estate Journal today. The Minnesota Real Estate Journal provides continuing education courses specifically in the commercial real estate market for agents and brokers and has done so for over 20 years. We put on about 30 courses a year, and this is a really important bill. I want to thank Representative Cleaforn for bringing it forward. As she mentioned in last fall in the discussion about bringing CEs online in the midst of COVID, there was further guidance issued by the department, which was a strict interpretation of the prohibited practices under the law, which for many providers meant that things that we had thought were okay to do in the provision of CE courses, it threw that into question a bit. And so what this does is essentially allow the course providers, as Representative Cleaborn mentioned, to engage in certain activities that allows us to thank sponsors, display logos, and have underwriters as part of these events for continuing education courses. And that's important because the sponsors and others help underwrite the cost of these events and keep the costs down for licensees who have to take these courses by law. And so based on our experience at Minnesota Real Estate Journal, the cost for a licensee to get their CEs would triple if we couldn't help use sponsors and other advertising to underwrite the cost of the event. So I think I want to thank Mr. Brickwitty from the department. We've worked hard on this over the last several months, have come to a place where we can keep costs down for enrollee or licensees, still put on good events, while also maintaining the integrity of the educational environment in the courses. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions and would ask the committee for its support of the bill and the DE. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I see Representative Lilly is paying very close attention to Mr. Reich's comments. I don't know if Representative Lilly has a question.
Mr. Chair, thank you for recognizing me, and Ms. Cleaborn, Representative Cleaborn, thank you for bringing this forward. Mr. Reich, I was just curious what Senator Marty has to, what he feels about this.
Mr. Reich.
Mr. Chair and members, I don't know. We haven't talked to Senator Marty about this particular issue, but I'm happy to follow up.
I think it would be good. Maybe you could report to the committee on that, Mr. Reich. I believe the next testifier on the agenda is Robin Rowan. Ms. Rowan.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Robin Rowan, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Independent Insurance Agents and Brokers. We represent over 6,500 insurance agents all over the state, and we've been providing CE classes for over 50 years. I very much want to thank Representative Cleaborn for bringing the bill forward and the Department of Commerce, Peter Brickwitty, for working with us on what we feel are incredibly common sense clarifications to current law. We hold over 200 CE classes a year, and over 3,000 agents take those classes annually. As JR mentioned, CE is expensive. We spend over $600,000 a year on CE, and we think it's really important that we keep that CE affordable for agents that are required to take it by the CE by the state. Having corporate sponsors helps us do this, and the clarifications in the bill will preserve our ability to provide value to these sponsors without compromising the quality of our classes. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Rowan. The next testifier is Peter Brickwitty from the Department of Commerce. Mr. Brickwitty.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Peter Brickwitty, Assistant Commissioner at the Commerce Department. I would echo the thanks from Mr. Reich and Ms. Rowan for the work on this bill and to Representative Cleaborn for authoring it. I can confirm from our end that we have reached an accord with the stakeholders after lots of discussion, which was good and helpful. And I would echo Mr. Reich's statements from earlier that a lot of this stemmed from the transition in early and sort of beginning about this time last year for CE providers to move their business from an in-person model to a fully online model. So this, I think, will provide some needed clarity. I think it is helpful for members to understand that the way that the language is constructed is in this portion of the bill is to read subdivisions 1 and 4 together. Reading them in concert, I think, articulates the differentiation which we and the stakeholders have, I think, been able to work out here between the display of a logo or the visual identity of an entity that is helping to sponsor an event versus a commercial that is run to a captive audience of continuing education students. And I think the language that we have here strikes that balance. So happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman. Thanks again for the opportunity to be on the record.
Thank you. Lucero, I see you're seeking recognition. I'm just going to take care of the amendment first, and then we'll come back to you for questions and discussion. Representative O'Driscoll, you've offered the A3 amendment. Would you like to move and describe that amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. I would move the A3 amendment to be adopted to House File 1768 as amended, and great care was taken to make sure that the amendment is drafted to the DE1 amendment so there aren't any technical issues, Mr. Chair. And we can do this in a way of me explaining the amendment. We can adopt the amendment. I would defer to Representative Claiborne of how she would like me to proceed on the conversation before or after the adoption of the amendment. It is a friendly amendment, so I will defer to Representative Claiborne.
Representative Claiborne.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. What I would like to say is it's been a pleasure to work with Representative O'Driscoll, and I would ask that he please explain the amendment to the members prior to the adoption. And then as Representative O'Driscoll said, this is a friendly amendment. I do plan to adopt it, and I appreciate the cooperation that we've had and the collegial working environment that we've had together.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Claiborne. There were a couple of CE or continuing education and education bills that were moving through the legislature at the same time. The base bill that we're looking at, 1768, and I had House File 737. And instead of having two separate bills that would make the general register and or the general orders in the Senate, we're looking to try to be efficient with two non-controversial bills by amending the language from House File 737 to House File 1768. There are three provisions that are contained for appraisers that are in House File 737 that are contained in the A3 amendment. The first, it allows appraisers to do what is called valuations, which are less than a full appraisal, and it provides clarity in state statute about what their requirements would be for that. Number two, it also provides for some cleanup on continuing education language, very much like the underlying bill does for appraisers, and providing some statutory changes. And number three, it also includes a two-credit requirement, not additional CE requirements for appraisers, but that two of the hours that would be required for continuing education be on the subject of valuation bias. This was something that was brought from the industry to us as something that they would like to see included. Valuation bias simply would mean something like this. And the case that I'm citing did not happen in the state of Minnesota, but it did happen in another state. A survey was done to check to see if laws, rules, and regulations were being followed. A woman answered the door, who was a Caucasian woman, to greet an appraiser to have her do an appraisal on her home. The pictures that were hanging in there was of the woman and her family. An appraisal was done. 1 week later, another appraiser was called back to that same property. But this time, a person of color answered the door. And again, family pictures and the like were of the person's family. Interestingly enough, two different appraisals were yielded with two different values on that property. we both know, I should say in both cases, we know that the valuation of that property is not affected by who the owner of that property is. It's affected by the market forces. And so to be in a proactive approach, the appraisers have asked that this licensing cycle, this two-hour requirement be put in. We have worked with the appraisers group. I have Byron Miller, who is from the Appraisal Advisory Task Force or board with the state of Minnesota, and Peter Brickwitty from the department, who are available to answer questions and to address this as well. And since it is Miller's 60th birthday today, I would ask that we give him the opportunity perhaps to address the committee on the amendment as well. Mr. Chair.
Well, since it's his birthday, Mr. Miller, I give you a brief opportunity. Happy birthday. I'm glad you're choosing to spend this occasion with us.
Thank you. I'm speechless there. I think that Representative O'Driscoll has pretty much covered all the bases with regards to this bill. The only clarification that I would have is that it is non-specific. It is not a two-hour bill. We are actually giving the providers the flexibility to determine how much time to devote to this. With that, I can answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Mr. Brickwitty, I understand, has a brief comment he'd like to make about the amendment as well. Mr. Brickwitty.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'd like to thank Representative O'Driscoll and Mr. Miller for the partnership on this bill. The department has is neutral on the evaluation portions of the bill, so I will limit my comments to the CE-related issues. Two things that are very helpful and very much needed from the department's perspective. One, I applaud Representative O'Driscoll and Mr. Miller for bringing forward the valuation bias, of course, language in the amendment. Does make a couple of technical changes, or particularly around the effective date. Thank you to Ms. Pompu for her assistance there to make sure that we can bring that into operation during the next licensure cycle. Second, the language in Section 10 of the amendment that is uncodified also allows us to do some federal conformity and align with federal guidance that was issued earlier this year that will allow CE providers to bring CE courses to appraisers in Minnesota without first incurring the cost of having it approved by another organization that is required currently under Minnesota law. That was guidance that was put in place by the federal appraisal regulatory body that states have been trying to align to throughout the country. That is effective through December 31st of 2021. So this change will allow us to bring that into immediate effect. And because I know Representative Davids is at home watching this live, I do want to echo the point that this is not adding any new continuing education requirements to appraisers this year, nor any other licensee in the state of Minnesota. So I know we would want to make sure we had that on the record for you, Representative Davids. Mr. Chair, happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Brickwitty.
Mr. Chair.
Discussion to the amendment, Representative Dabney. I think, Representative Lucero, you're to the bill, right, not to the amendment? Yeah, Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just need to correct the record here. Representative O'Driscoll stated that the valuation of a home on an appraisal is based not on the race of the homeowner but on the market conditions. That simply is not the experience of too many of our African-American, particularly neighbors. There's a long pattern of racial inequity in the real estate market, redlining, subprime mortgages, significant gap in home ownership. In nationally, 72% of white families own their home, 42% of black families. There's a persistent pattern that many have experienced of black homeowners finding that their homes are appraised for less than their white neighbors' homes are. The comps that the appraiser uses sometimes are different, leading to a lower valuation. So the idea that it's simply the market doesn't fit the fact pattern. And I just don't think we should persist with that inaccuracy in the committee's debate. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. And I will note for the committee that we are having Dr. Bruce Corey next Tuesday to discuss the economic cost of systemic racism in Minnesota. I think this is exactly the kind of discussion that we're going to have on Tuesday. I think that's what Dr. Corey's research and a lot of it's well documented impact on of systemic racism on the real estate market. So your comments well taken. Any further discussion to the amendment? Hearing none. All in favor of the A3 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the A3 amendment is adopted. Discussion to the bill. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to briefly give my support for this bill. I appreciate this. As somebody who's actually going through my CE, I've done the CEs just recently to renew my qualified builder license. I do CEs every year, obviously for real estate as well. And this bill very much makes it clear and is appreciated by the thousands upon thousands of Minnesotans who have to go through CEs, and we want to have our costs as low as possible. And so I just wanted to give that thanks. But as to the unfortunate comments we just heard, Representative Dabney is wrong. The value, the market value of a piece of any real estate is not dictated by a person's race. The market value is market forces.
I'm going to ask you we'll have that discussion on Tuesday. You can follow up on that on Tuesday. Any further discussion to the bill? Hearing none, Representative Cleaborn, do you have any closing comments?
I would just like to thank the committee for their time for a robust debate. We love the House committee meetings for that reason. I would also like to thank Representative O'Driscoll for his work and partnership in this bill. Members, I ask for your support. This is a very important bill, as we've heard this morning, and thank you so much for your time.
All right. I will renew my motion that House File 1758, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the general register. Mr. Brown will take the roll, and the chair votes aye.
Vice Chair Katiza-Watoon.
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Aye.
Representative Barr.
Aye.
Representative Carlson.
Carlson, aye.
Representative Dabney.
Aye.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Haley.
Aye.
Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Representative Lee. Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard, aye.
Representative Lucero.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, aye.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Representative Tice.
Aye.
Representative Lee.
With 17 ayes and 0 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 1768 is recommended to be placed on the general register. Before we move to the next bill, I do just want to indicate to members we have 42 minutes left in three bills to get through. The chair very much wants to get through all three bills, so let's try and be mindful of that time. The next bill is from our very own Representative Richardson, Chair Richardson's bill 1080. Chair Richardson, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I'd like to make a motion to recommend House File 1080 be placed on the general register.
And we also have a Chair Richardson moves House File 1080 be placed on the general register. We have an author's amendment A3. Would you like to move that author's amendment?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. The A3 amendment makes a few technical changes and clarifications. It clarifies under Section 2 of the bill that the provisions would not require referrals or recommendations for transplants that are not medically appropriate given the individual's overall health condition. And it also clarifies that a covered entity is not required to provide supported decision-making services. And I would love to move the A3 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Chair Richardson moves the A3 amendment. Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the A3 amendment is adopted. Chair Richardson, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1080 seeks to address discrimination in the organ transplant process. Since organ transplants became available as a treatment option, people with disabilities have faced significant barriers to accessing the life-saving procedure. 16 states have passed similar legislation, and there are 7 other states that are considering legislation currently. Denying organ transplants to people with intellectual and neurodevelopmental disabilities like autism and Down syndrome solely on the basis of their disability is an issue that we have the ability to address. Research has found that an estimated 44% of organ transplant centers said that they would not add a child with some level of neurodevelopmental disability to an organ transplant list. 85% of transplant centers might consider the disability as a factor in deciding whether to add a person to a list. Organ transplant centers have their own policies and practices governing how they decide to treat patients and which they decide to accept and submit to the national waiting list. Some current and past practices treat psychiatric disabilities, intellectual and developmental disabilities as an absolute contraindication to transplant, meaning that a particular candidate for organ transplant is unsuitable for organ transplantation due solely to their disability. A 2019 report from the National Council on Disability found that many doctors worry that these intellectual or neurodevelopmental disabilities will make transplants more dangerous, or that the transplant will not improve the quality of an individual's life. And others believe patients won't comply with post-surgical instructions, but the research proves that that is inaccurate. When we're looking at the survival rate for people with intellectual disabilities with transplants, it's the same nationwide overall for the survival rate for kidney transplants for individuals without disabilities. And we're also able to see that the 5-year graft survival rate for patients with intellectual disability was identical to the rate for matched patients without an intellectual disability. And with looking at heart transplants, 4 out of 5 patients with a disability survive, and that is comparable to what we see with non-disabled people as well. There is a 2019 report from the National Council on Disability urging state legislatures to adopt clear and detailed laws prohibiting this type of discrimination. And this bill would ensure that health plans that provide coverage for transplants not deny coverage on the basis of disability, deny eligibility, or act in any way to induce providers to not provide care solely on the basis of disability. And we know that the lives of people with disabilities are equally valuable to those without, and that healthcare decisions shouldn't be made that devalue their lives. So with that, Mr. Chair, happy to move on to other testifiers and stand for questions.
Thank you, Chair Richardson. We do have a couple testifiers signed up. The first testifier is Erica Hillier. Ms. Hillier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for taking the time to hear from me today. My name is Erica Hillier, and on September 10th, 2018, I gave birth to 7 pounds and 8 ounces of absolute perfection, my first child, Jonathan Milo. That day changed my life in obvious ways, but it was also the day I could no longer ignore, even unintentionally, the largest minority group in the country, the disabled. You see, Johnny has surprised us with an extra chromosome. There are a lot of assumptions that come with a diagnosis of Down syndrome. Without knowing him, people make assumptions about my son's abilities solely based on his diagnosis. Worse, people will also make assumptions about his worth and his quality of life. People wonder if we wish he'd been born neurotypical or if we were worried our next child might also have Down syndrome. The answer to that is an emphatic no, by the way. We would be lucky to have another child just like Johnny, truly. Today, Johnny's a 2.5-year-old ball of fire. He learns sign language faster than his dad and I can keep up with. He models for Target, and I've never been teased by a toddler more seriously in my life. The idea that he might be denied an organ transplant if he ever needed one simply because of an extra chromosome and someone else's preconceived idea of what that means for his life is a tragedy. Anyone who meets Johnny would tell you he is absolutely worthy of life, and yet it happens. Around the country and here in Minnesota, people with disabilities are still being denied life-saving organ transplants, are being placed lower on the wait list, or aren't even being referred in the first place simply because of their disability, not because they aren't medically qualified. In the process of pursuing this legislation, I was contacted by a Minnesota mother, Nikki Golden. Her teenage son, Bryce, has autism and was denied being placed on the transplant list by two Minnesota hospitals. The family was told the reason for refusal was due to his autism diagnosis and their belief that he wouldn't be able to comply as needed, despite him repeatedly demonstrating that he would. Eventually, one of Bryce's doctors told the family that they needed to go elsewhere for a transplant because Bryce was out of time and Minnesota was just getting in the way. Thankfully, Nikki and Bryce were able to relocate to a state where this legislation had already been passed, and Bryce received his liver transplant last year. Still, no Minnesotan should have to leave our state and be separated from their family to access necessary life-saving health care. 4 weeks ago, I gave birth to another son, just as perfect, loud, loved, and valuable as my first. But one less chromosome means I will never have to worry about a medical professional deciding that his life is not worth saving. The worth of my firstborn is not and should never be in question. Johnny is fully human, and as such, he should have the same access to organ transplants and anatomical gifts that you or I would. File 1080 will ensure that medically eligible patients in Minnesota who have cognitive, developmental, intellectual, neurological, or physical disabilities are never discriminated against when seeking an organ transplant.
Thank you, Ms.
I hope that everyone works to move House File 1080 forward without hesitation, not just for me and my family, but for all Minnesotans.
Thank you, Ms. Hillier, and we'll take that as enthusiastic support right there. So our next testifier is Amanda Collins. Ms. Collins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Amanda Collins. My youngest son has Down syndrome and a congenital heart defect. My eldest son actually selected organ transplant discrimination as his high school senior government project, which included reaching out to his representative, and is the reason why I'm here speaking with you today. My youngest is a happy, energetic 6-year-old kindergartner who loves Mickey Mouse, Paw Patrol, and playing with his siblings, cousins, and friends. He has a congenital heart defect, and during our prenatal ultrasounds, it appeared his heart was unbalanced, which comes with many surgeries and typically requires a heart transplant for long-term survival. His final diagnosis is still a very complex heart defect, and after two open heart surgeries, his heart is mended but not fixed. We know he will need additional surgeries, and we don't know what the future will bring with his complex heart. This bill is necessary because even though we have amazing doctors and hospitals in Minnesota, there is provider bias that starts as early as the referring physician. This bias of doctors around treatment options for those with disabilities is something we have dealt with since before my son was born. We've had to seek out second opinions to get the care my son deserves. Not organ transplant related, but our most notable experience has been with my son's tethered spinal cord diagnosis. This is a diagnosis that is typically made around 6 months of age. We continued to hear, give him more time. Delays are expected with Down syndrome. When we raised concerns of his delays, lack of standing and walking, even in comparison with his peers with Down syndrome. It took us going to the Down syndrome clinic where a physician finally listened and pushed for testing, which finally led to the correct diagnosis, which allowed surgery at 4.5. This 4-year delay may result in my son suffering from permanent complications. If provider bias with a tethered spinal cord diagnosis resulted in a 4-year delay in treatment, what type of provider bias is impacting individuals with a disability that need a time-sensitive, life-saving organ transplant? Our story has many parallels to one of the written testimonies you received from another Minnesota mom, Carolyn Petrie. Her prenatal ultrasound showed her son's multiple heart defects could lead to a heart transplant, and she asked her cardiologist how many surgeries her son's heart could withstand before he would need a transplant. With a matter-of-fact tone of voice, the cardiologist informed her that he may be able to get through 5 surgeries, but ultimately would not qualify for a transplant simply because he has Down syndrome. This bill not only impacts my family and my community of friends, but also what drives me at my job at Be the Match National Marrow Donor Program. Daily, I get to see how we are successfully serving patients in need of cellular therapy, most notably bone marrow transplants. This bill will help ensure all people, irrespective of disability, are able to access the cellular therapy that they need. We want to make sure families like the Benders, who you also received a written testimony from, no longer hear the words, "Your child will not be eligible for a marrow transplant because of their disability." On behalf of my son, my family, and his sibling advocate, I am requesting your support of House File 1080. We want to make sure that if he or anyone else with a disability needs a transplant, that their disability diagnosis is not utilized as the reason to delay or deny a transplant. It should not be up to the doctor insurance company to determine if their life is worth saving. The same assessment process should be followed for any individual who needs a life-saving transplant. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Collins. All right, there are no further testifiers signed up either from the public or from the author. We will move to member discussion and questions. Any discussion to the bill? Seeing none, any closing comments, Representative Richardson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to present the bill, and I'd also like to thank my testifiers today and would just ask for member support.
Thank you, Chair Richardson. And Chair Richardson renews her motion that House File 1080 be recommended to be placed on the general register. Mr. Brown will take the roll. The chair votes aye.
Vice Chair Cortizo Atum.
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Aye.
Representative Barr. Representative Carlson.
Carlson, aye.
Representative Dabney.
Dabney, aye.
Representative Elkins.
Elkins, aye.
Representative Haley.
Enthusiastic, aye.
Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard, aye.
Representative Lucero.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, aye.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Representative Tice.
Aye.
Representative Barr.
There being 17 ayes and 0 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 1080 is recommended to be placed on the general register. Thank you, Chair Richardson and testifiers. The next item on the agenda is House File 55. Just by way of explanation to the members, this is a bill that we've heard a lot about from Representative Rasmussen and a few other committee members. In amendment form, and I thought since Representative Elkins has worked so hard on this bill, I wanted to give him the opportunity to describe his own bill. So we put it on the calendar today. Representative Elkins, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would like to, well, I think we're going to lay this over, aren't we?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'll just put the bill on the floor to be laid over for further discussion, so.
Representative moves House File 55 before the committee to be laid over for further consideration. Representative Elkins, to your bill.
Yes, thank you. So anyone who has served at least one full term on this committee has learned to dread 2 days on the Commerce Committee's calendar. The first one is Liquor Day, and the second one is Rare Disease and Healthcare Mandate Day. So we have had the Healthcare Mandate Day. We have not yet had Liquor Day, so we have that to look forward to, presumably. But this bill is really more for us than anything else, because, you know, every year we, you know, receive, a series of bills that would implement, you know, one or more, you know, healthcare mandates. And one of the things that's been very frustrating to me is that we don't really have any objective mechanism for ourselves to be presented with objective information about whether the suggested mandate makes sense or not. And as I've learned this year, frequently the proxy for that ends up being a fiscal note that we receive from MMB related to the State Employees Group Insurance Plan. And as I've also learned, sometimes the quality of those fiscal notes isn't that great because they're thrown together in a hurry. The quality just isn't there. And to my Republican colleagues, I would say that with respect to that, that the insertion of the new legislative budget office into that process has not significantly improved it. When I introduced this bill, it's number 55. I had another one, 56, which was one of those mandate bills. And in that case, the mandate in question related to lymphedema compression garments. When I looked at that bill and agreed to author it, I looked at it in the context of would that particular mandate pass the test
that was, you know, called, laid out in House File 55 and concluded that it would probably. In fact, I wanted 56 to be the guinea pig to try out 55. Because in that case, the mandated study had been done. The state of Virginia already has a mandate like that. Did the study show that the covering lymphedema compression garments saved money, actually? So that's the context of this bill. Again, it's for us. It's to make sure that when we're considering these bills, we have objective information, that time has been taken to provide that evaluation. It's not some fiscal note that MMB has thrown together hurriedly related to the impact on CGIP. So I think we have Mr. Bentley Graves from the chamber would also like to speak to this bill as well. So, but that's my introduction. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. We do have a number of testifiers here. We can start with Mr. Graves. Mr. Graves.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and thank you, Representative Elkins, for that kind of summary of the bill. I think you explained it well and explained what we too hope would be the usefulness of it in the process of weighing out the costs and benefit of proposed mandates. You know, this committee has heard me talk about mandates and the chamber's perspective on this, so I won't go over all of that, but just suffice to say that we very much agree with Representative Elkins that when these proposals come up, there's not a good way to kind of judge that cost benefit, you know, and really the only kind of yardstick we have with which to do that is a potential fiscal note, whether for public programs or for the state employee program. And as Representative Elkins noted, that is not a perfect process. And that's not to say that the process outlined in this bill is perfect in every respect either. But we do believe that taking the review process that's currently on the books that is permissive and making it more of a required part of the analysis as these bills move through the legislative process would be helpful, as Representative Elkins said, both to you all as legislators, as policymakers, but frankly also to those of us in the stakeholder community, and would help inform our advocacy around these proposals, knowing that all of them bring some benefit to somebody, but that likely they all come with some cost. But obviously there's always a careful balance between the two, and we really do believe that this could be a very useful tool in helping move these conversations along in a much more informed way. So thank you, Representative Elkins, for bringing this forward. Thank you for the committee's continued discussion of this broader topic on several occasions thus far this session. And thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing for the discussion today. I'm happy to stand for any questions. And again, just appreciate the committee's time on this issue.
Thank you, Mr. Graves. We do have two additional testifiers, Mr. Bob Stein from the Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters. Mr. Stein.
Thank you. Appreciate the time, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Bob Stein. I work with Armbruster Executive Employee Benefits, and I'm here today representing Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters. We call it MAHU. MAHU supports House File 55, a bill to strengthen the current mandate review process. The Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters is the largest association representing health and benefit insurance agents. Our clients are individuals and employers in the state. More than anyone, we represent the voice of insurance consumers, if you will. Each legislative session, lawmakers are asked to consider the inclusion of additional mandates to Minnesota's fully insured health insurance policies. While always well-intentioned, such mandates increase costs to consumers and reduce consumer choice. The additional costs of these mandates are not paid by insurance companies, as many assume, but are instead passed on to consumers in the form of higher premiums. The state has more mandates than in Minnesota than any other state. Most legislators are not aware that the mandates they pass only apply to select few of their constituents, those that are in the fully insured market, which is designed for individuals and small businesses. This segment of the market has been shrinking for years and now represents 19.6% of the privately insured Minnesotans, or 26% of all Minnesotans. As new mandates increase prices, they drive more employers to self-insured market, which is regulated by the federal government and not subject to state mandates or the substantial state taxes assessed to that market segment. Mandates also create a competitive disadvantage for small employers who must compete for labor and against large employers and the self-insured markets that benefit from the absence of the mandates and taxes. So we ask for your support of HF 55 to strengthen the mandate review process, which will give you better analysis of which each proposed mandate will mean for individuals and small businesses as far as costs. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Stein. Our last testifier is Dan Andreessen from the Council of Health Plans. Mr. Andreessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Thanks for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 55. And would like to thank Representative Elkins for his leadership on this issue. Health plans currently provide coverage for the Affordable Care Act's 10 essential health benefits, in addition to the more than 60 mandated health benefits, which have been passed by the legislature in previous sessions. As Mr. Stein mentioned, because of the way that insurance is regulated, these mandates can only apply to those in the fully insured market, but also those in state public programs and CEGA. Everything that's built into health insurance coverage has a cost because the insurance is used to pay for healthcare services. The amount of premiums, co-pays, and other out-of-pocket costs is a reflection of the cost to pay doctors, hospitals, and for any other medical equipment needed to provide care. So when a new mandate is added to a plan's benefit, there is going to be an added cost because there is a healthcare professional who's going to be paid to provide that care. This is why when legislation is debated to require coverage for a new benefit that's not an existing plan, the council has testified with concerns about the impact this could have on increasing premiums for everyone in the fully insured market. It's often difficult to project these costs, as has been mentioned, but House File 55 is a way to provide these answers. Sometimes it's possible to get a glimpse of potential costs when legislation triggers a fiscal note because of projected financial impacts to state public programs and CEGA. If there is a financial impact to these two programs, there will also be an impact to the commercial market. However, sometimes we're unable to use this as a guide because we see situations where a proposed mandate is exempted from state public programs and CEGA, often to avoid a fiscal note. And we've seen this situation with several bills this session. House File 55 in many ways is a fiscal note for impacts on the commercial market. As health plans, we strive to offer a comprehensive benefit that can provide access to all types of care, but these products must also be affordable and at a level that individuals and small businesses can purchase these products in the fully insured market. The COVID-19 pandemic has illustrated the importance of health insurance coverage and how it's vital to keep the fully insured market stable so we can keep the uninsured rate down. House File 55 will provide you and your colleagues more information so you can make informed decisions when debating new coverage mandates. 27 other states have this some form of mandate review in place, and we urge your support of House File 55. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Andreessen. There's no further testifiers, so we'll move to member discussion and questions, and I will just start by, because I know how much work you've put in to this particular provision. You and I have had a lot of good conversations about it, and I know that there are, you know, while there are other perhaps members of the legislature who are not, you know, big fans of this, I think that you have an idea here that is worthy of further consideration, so I was glad to give it a hearing today, and I hope you continue to work on it. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and first off, you know, just a big thank you to Representative Elkins for all of his thoughtful leadership and work on this complicated issue, and then also, Mr. Chair, appreciate you giving the bill a hearing today. I won't repeat what has been said by Representative Elkins or the testifiers. I agree with everything they said. The only thing I'd underscore for the committee is that this, you know, House File 55, if it becomes law, it doesn't tie our hands. We can still pass these mandates and evaluate them. It just makes sure that we have the critical information we need to make better decisions, to make the right decisions, but it doesn't tie our hands in terms of passing mandates in the future. But thank you again, Mr. Chair and Representative Elkins, for leading on this issue.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Elkins. Today is the day, right? We finally get House File 55 in front of the committee. It's like going to the movie and seeing the trailer each and every time, but it's on the screen, but it's not the full version of the movie. So today we have the chance to be able to see that full version of the movie. I just want to compliment you for your hard work on this. This is the right approach. Maybe it's not the right complete everything, but it's the right approach to doing this, to put things through a vetting process to make sure that we know what the costs are so that the legislature can make an informed decision on this and that we are addressing people's needs. As a matter of fact, I can tell you, Representative Elkins, that some of the members who are on the GOP side of the committee have also agreed to sign on as co-authors to your bill. So you do have our support, and the chair, as he said, also supports this. So maybe we can get some traction, if not this biennium, or this session rather, the next year in the biennium, because this is definitely a positive for Minnesota and for properly addressing concerns about mandates and health insurance costs, and can help us to, again, address some of those rising costs that people have concerns about. So hats off to Representative Elkins. Thank you, sir.
All right. I see no members seeking recognition, so I will give Representative Elkins a chance for some brief closing comments, keeping in mind we do have one bill left on the agenda and only 15 minutes left. Representative Elkins.
Yeah, just very brief. This is the first time the bill has been heard on relatively short notice. It does need some work. I understand, for example, that the bill is moving in the Senate, that Senator Benson, for example, has expressed some grave concerns about the language on 415 to 417 that would kind of handcuff committee chairs from even hearing such bills. So that would probably come out. The bill is alive for potential end of session negotiation. So I would say if there are members who have feedback for me on ways this bill could be improved, reach out to me directly, because it is an outside possibility that it could emerge from negotiations in some form, and I'd like it to be in better shape. So, but again, what I see here, the key thing is this would give us a better way of getting the information to evaluate these things than getting a last minute and hurriedly thrown together fiscal note from CGIP, which I'm not real happy with that part of the process this year. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. So Representative Elkins renews his motion that House File 55 be laid over. The bill is laid over. The last item on the agenda is House File 372 by our very own Representative O'Driscoll. Representative O'Driscoll, would you like to move your bill?
Mr. Chair, I move that House File 372 be re-referred from the committee to the General Register.
Representative O'Driscoll moves House File 372 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. We do have an author's amendment, the A1. Would you like to move that amendment, Representative O'Driscoll?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A1 amendment. And before we vote on it, let me just tell you, this clarifies the rulemaking process to allow for an expedited rulemaking on here, and I will explain why that is important when we get into the context of the bill once it's amended in the form I would like to discuss it today. Members, I encourage your support on the A1.
Representative O'Driscoll moves the A1, which gets the bill in the shape he would like us to consider it. Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and A1 is adopted. Representative O'Driscoll, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. What House File 372 does, and there's also a companion in the Senate House, Senate File 122 that is moving as well. The purpose for this bill is to allow for clarification and the inclusion of three other data points into the discussion on how worker comp rates are calculated. And this bill has no opposition that we are aware of. And the three data points that are now going to be able to be included in the computation for worker comp rates are going to be what we call the ultimate level. And ultimate level very briefly says, what's the anticipated total cost of a disability if it happens perhaps to a young worker where there may be 35, 40 years of lost income? Now there's a cap on it. This allows for companies to be able to, when they're doing ratings, making those decisions, take into account a fuller picture for the individual. The second thing it does, it allows us to take into consideration trends. So as industries maybe become more safe or new industries are being added that are being covered by worker comp rates, that we can more effectively in real time address what those costs are going to be for worker comp claims and have funds available for that. And third, it takes into account the full cost of actually settling a claim with the administrative and adjusting costs that are associated with this. To the best of my recollection, as I said, there is no opposition. I do have Mr. Brickwitty from the Department of Commerce here today who may have some comments. Ms. Everling and Mr. Cocking, who are both from the insurance industry. And just a couple of other quick notes before I turn it back to you, Mr. Chair, for questions and testimony. I've been asked, will this go in front of the Worker Comp Advisory Council? What's their role in this? The Work Comp Advisory Council has jurisdiction under Chapter 176 in statute. This bill does not fall under that, but as a good housekeeping measure, this provision was brought before the Work Comp Council, and there were no questions or issues from them on what was going on with this. And finally, to the rulemaking provision, it allows for expedited rulemaking so that we can get these three data items that I talked about included so that we can start immediately working with those instead of waiting for two or three more years as we wait for the rulemaking process and rate determinations. And again, to summarize that, get it more real time so that we have the proper codes and classifications for folks. Mr. Chair, with that, that ends my comments on what I believe is a non-controversial bill and is who's no longer on the committee, but has been referenced once earlier today. We have Peace in the Valley, Representative Greg Davis.
Very glad to hear it. The first and only testifier on the who signed up is Mr. Aaron Cocking of the Insurance Federation. Mr. Cocking.
Mr. Chairman, Aaron Cocking, Insurance Federation. Representative O'Driscoll did a great job. I'm here to answer any questions. As he said, this is pretty non-controversial, but if there are questions, happy to answer them.
All right. As I mentioned, there are no further testifiers, so we will now move to member discussion and questions. Any discussion to the bill? Hearing none, Representative O'Driscoll, would you like to have any closing comments and renew your motion?
The good bill vote yes, and with that, Mr. Chair, I renew my motion that House File 372, as amended, be referred to the General Register.
Representative O'Driscoll renews his motion that House File 372 as amended be recommended to be placed on the General Register. Mr. Brown will take the roll. The chair votes aye.
Vice Chair Cortez Watoon.
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Aye.
Representative Barr.
Aye.
Representative Carlson.
Carlson, aye.
Representative Dabney.
Dabney, aye.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Haley.
Aye.
Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Representative Lee. Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard, aye.
Representative Lucero.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, aye.
Representative Richardson. Representative Tice.
Aye.
Representative Lee. And Representative Richardson.
Aye.
With 17 ayes and 0 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 372, as amended, is recommended to be placed on the General Register. That is the conclusion of our agenda today. Since we have a couple minutes, I will just give the committee a brief roadmap for what is ahead of us. Next week, we will be looking at, as I mentioned on Tuesday, I'm very excited, we will have Dr. Bruce Corey joining the committee as we talk about the economic cost of systemic racism in Minnesota. I think that is a very great way for us to begin our discussion about our priorities in the budget and in our committee bill, which we are entering that stage of time as today is, of course, second deadline. We will hear a couple of additional bills next week. Two have been posted. There may be another one. Of course, then we will have spring break, and when we return, we will be taking up our budget bill. So that's kind of a roadmap for the rest of for the next couple weeks anyway. Representative O'Driscoll, did you have a question?
Mr. Chair, if you are done, I was just going to remind GOP committee members that we're going to have a very short meeting after this. Please check your email for the Zoom link, and it will be a short meeting. And I thank you, Mr. Chair.
And DFL members, you get to enjoy your Friday. You're luckier than the GOP, apparently. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.